Hello, on this week's program, Susan Lewis looks at Cézanne and Beyond, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's upcoming exhibition about the impact of the 19th century French artist, father of modern painting. We speak with one of the region's most promising young musicians. Violinist Benjamin Bielman, a student at Curtis, is one of 8 Astral Artistic Services National Audition winners. He's also just won the Il Milka Astral Violin Prize. Jason Pfeiffer explores the rich history of the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, considered the nation's oldest continuously operating theatre. And we look ahead to the Alumni Travel Grant Exhibition at the Centre for Emerging Visual Artists. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia region is home to more of the works of Paul Cézanne than anywhere else in the world. In the summer of 1996, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Cézanne retrospective drew almost 550,000 visitors. While that exhibition focused on 170 works by the 19th century French painter, a new show now celebrates the impact of Cézanne, both on his peers and the generations that followed. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores Cézanne and beyond.
Cézanne's 1885 oil on canvas, The Bather, is among the first works to greet visitors in the new show. On a canvas over 4 feet tall, a lean young man in a small swimsuit looks down at the sand, hands resting on his hips, his muscular left leg taking a step forward. But shift to the side and look beyond the gallery wall. A Picasso's Bather is visible in the room up ahead. An angular sculpture, the arms set on the hips, appears to mirror the Bather of Cézanne. Joe Rischel, the museum's curator of European painting before 1900, says the experience of this show is one of ongoing visual discovery.
There's tons of information. There's a 600-page book to use. There's an acoustic guide. There are labels. But finally, making the relationships, getting into the conversations is the important thing.
And part of the fun of Cézanne and Beyond, which explores not just the French master, but the artists who came after, and the connections between them all. Cézanne himself has been alternately described as impressionist, post-impressionist, the father of modern painting, and the bridge between impressionism and cubism. Although in the 1860s and 70s, he was part of the group of young painters who were bucking tradition, creating paintings with colorful little slaps or licks of paint, Joe Rischel says Cézanne rather quickly began painting in a way that set him apart from his impressionist contemporaries.
Cézanne starts taking those dashes and putting them in a very structured, concrete, sort of bricklayer, he was called at the time, way of a lucid building of things that has less and less to do with immediate optical reality. If the Monet, the leaf, the wind picks up the leaf and catches the light, that's what he tells you about. Nothing ever moves in Cézanne. If you see a duck in the water in Cézanne, which you will only occasionally, that duck is stuck there for life.
Whether painting a fishing village, a collection of fruit, or a portrait of his wife, Cézanne's use of color, brushstrokes, and form were bold, overtaking perspective, creating images that didn't quite look like real life. This is not what the art establishment of the time regarded as fine art.
A picture like this would have been uncomfortable, as it may be still uncomfortable for people today because of the odd perspective.
Scott Schaefer is senior curator of paintings at the Getty Museum, which has loaned to this show an 1894 still life.
He shows a tabletop, a piece of cloth, various ceramic vessels, as well as the apples falling out of the dish. The sense of disequilibrium that you feel standing in front of this picture is caused by the instability of the objects, which makes us slightly anxious when we look at a Cézanne still life.
And yet, by choosing not to replicate reality, Cézanne changed the idea of what a painting could be, says adjunct curator Kathy Sachs.
Painting was important in its own right. The work of art was a two-dimensional surface covered with paint. And Cézanne made us very aware of that. His foregrounds and backgrounds merge, and he actually creates an object that will therefore take you into the 21st century if you think about what kind of painting there is today.
In 1895, French dealer Ambroise Vollard mounted a one-person show of Cézanne's work, which drew artists like Matisse, Degas, Monet, Renoir, and Pizarro, a number of whom purchased paintings. In 1907, a year after Cézanne's death at age 67, a large show in Paris attracted people from all over Europe. And since then, Artists have been crediting him with opening their eyes.
Picasso says Cézanne is the father of us all. Matisse says, if Cézanne's right, I'm right. And so it goes, down to Jasper Johns or Ellsworth Kelly.
Bryce Martin called Cézanne my hero, and they each have a very personal response to Cézanne.
This exhibition of over 150 works is about one-third Cézanne, two-thirds work by 18 other artists from 9 different countries. The mostly paintings, but also sculpture and a couple of large photographs, are displayed in open, connected galleries, clustered thematically with at least one work by Cézanne close by to illustrate the ways the artists approached similar subjects. Take, for example, the large gallery space devoted to bathers, where two large Cézannes congregate with Picasso's bather sculptures in the center of the room and works by Matisse, Jasper Johns, and Bryce Martin on opposing walls.
You can see Picasso reacting to Cézanne's bathers, and you can see Jasper Johns reacting to Picasso's bathers. And that's what the show is all about, that domino effect. There is a diver figure in the Picasso bathers. There is a diver figure in the Jasper Johns fall.
Some references are explicit, as in Johns tracing after Cézanne. Other connections are more subtle, like contemporary artist Bryce Martin's large abstract Red Rocks, in which wavy lines of color are set against a reddish-brown background. Kathy Sachs says the 21st century work was based on Martin's study of the large bathers from the National Gallery.
The proportions of the painting are exactly the same as the proportions of the National Gallery bather, but they are much larger. And during the whole time he was painting this series of paintings, he had a postcard of the National Gallery bather in his studio.
The variety of artistic and human responses to Cézanne illustrates his lasting power, says Joe Rischel.
For my generation, he was this titanic giant, John Wayne, chest-pounding, high testosteronic, sort of boom-boom, maker of monuments, you know, the great builder of absolute things. On the other side, I think Cézanne is a very funny, witty man of great sophistication. And I think what we try by putting him in different contexts in this to see how certain artists saw the wit.
Placed near Cézanne's famous painting of French country workmen playing cards is a nearly 4-foot square transparency and light box by Canadian artist Jeff Walls, also titled Card Players.
He literally gets actors and a built set and stages the card players, which is very funny because they're nice middle-aged ladies playing canasta.
Cézanne did not teach and became somewhat of a loner. He had a wife and son and worked much of his later life in his hometown region of Provence, but he remained driven in his work.
He wanted to be part of the grand destiny of art as he understood it.
He knew he was doing something different. I don't think he knew what it was. I don't think he knew where it would go or who would take it up and what would happen from there.
Cézanne's willingness to break with convention was clearly contagious, spreading throughout Europe and traveling across the Atlantic. And while Paul Cézanne may never have come to Philadelphia, he lives here nonetheless, in the high concentration of his works in the region and in shows like this one that celebrate those he's inspired for more than a century.
WRTI Susan Lewis. Cézanne and Beyond opens at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on Thursday and runs through May 17th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Astral Artists is the Philadelphia-based nonprofit that helps promising musicians transition from school to professional careers. In the past, it has helped to establish now prominent stars like pianist Simona Dinnerstein, guitarist Jason Vio, soprano Indra Thomas, and basso Eric Owens. Each year, Astral recruits new artists. Participants from around the country and beyond go through a rigorous selection process to be invited to audition in person. This year's auditions took place over 4 days in January, and the selection panel of seasoned professionals chose 8 young artists to join Astral's current roster. Among these is 19-year-old violinist Benjamin Bielman, a student at the Curtis Institute of Music, who, in addition to being selected for representation by Astral, was also awarded the Milka Astral Violin Prize, a $5,000 discretionary award to help pay for participation in international violin competitions and professional career development. I met with Ben Bielman earlier this week at Curtis.
My parents are avid music lovers, and they both played piano in high school, but they never really pursued it further than that. Well, I have a sister that's 2 years older than me, and she started violin 2 years before me when she was 5, so I would have been 3 at the time. And you know, they had Suzuki lessons, and my sister would do group classes with her friends. And for private lessons, my mom would drag me along, you know, to all of her lessons and sit me on the floor and everything. And eventually, I guess I started humming and picking up the simple Suzuki stuff and, you know, kind of humming it around the house. And when I was five, I asked if I could start the violin, too, because, you know, especially back then, you know, I idolized my sister. She was my big role model.
When does somebody of that age get any idea, or does it matter that you're any good?
In terms of, I mean, being good or not, I don't know if that's the most important question. It's more like, do you like it? And I guess at that age, can you tolerate, you know, practicing for 10, 20, 30 minutes at a time, you know? I actually really decided that music was going to be my passion. I mean, I had felt it, but I really made the choice when I was about 11 or 12. And, you know, I just knew that I had to put 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours of practice in, and unfortunately cut away some of my soccer time, you know, my time with friends, you know, time to go to the movies or whatever.
String players have the option of either pursuing a career as a soloist or in an orchestra, in an ensemble. Is that a decision you make early on, or is it something you know, or what have you thought about?
Some people do make that decision fairly early on. I myself don't necessarily know where my path will lie. I don't know if I'm going to be in an orchestra, you know, maybe leading a section in an orchestra, playing in the section of an orchestra, chamber music, solo career. I honestly have no idea. I've been fortunate to be able to spend the past couple summers at Marlboro, the Marlboro Music Festival, playing some great chamber music with fantastic musicians. I'm here at Curtis, which has a phenomenal symphony, obviously, you know, in experiences that you'll remember for the rest of your life as a symphony player. And, you know, I have performance opportunities through here and through Astral as well, as, you know, on a solo or recital stage. I honestly would love to be a soloist. I mean, I don't necessarily want to have the whole diva image. I'm not necessarily going out as a, you know, I need to make the money, I need to get the girls type of thing. I'd like to...
But it's no harm either.
Yeah, of course not. I'd like to, you know, I guess have my voice as a soloist. And I find the most joy in playing in front of an orchestra. I mean, obviously that's the dream of everyone else out there. But I would really be happy just doing just about anything in music. And I haven't really settled on a specific path, but I know that I'm surrounded by great people and great musicians.
What does the Astral Connection mean to you at this point in your career?
Astral is a perfect, in my opinion, a perfect organization for me at this point, because I'm trying to make the transition from, you know, student to young professional to starting to get my name out there. To make a living in whatever it is I do, whatever people like me to do. Astral is extraordinarily nurturing. They give you tons and tons of outreach concerts to the community, you know, to retirement homes, to schools, where you can run through programs for bigger venues. But also, I mean, just the idea of outreach to me is really great, because I think a lot of times people think, oh, you know, outreach, that's for other people, you know, that's not for me, that's for some other people who need to make a living. But I think outreach is a huge part of being a modern musician.
Violinist Benjamin Beelman, one of 8 new additions to Astral Artists roster and the winner of the Milka Astral Violin Prize. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia recently celebrated its 200th anniversary, highlighting its distinction as the oldest theatre in the country. However, the Walnut isn't the only theatre in Pennsylvania that stakes a claim in American theatre history. Since its opening in 1852, the doors of the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster County have remained open, making it the oldest continuously operating theatre building in the nation. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the National Historic Landmark Theatre recently named a new artistic director who aims to preserve the theatre's rich heritage while taking the company into new territory.
The Fulton Opera House sits on a busy street in Lancaster City, just around the corner from the town's main square and a few blocks from City Hall. Built in 1852 as a town meeting hall, it has also always been a theater, a place for live theatrical productions, films, and spectacle. Throughout the last century, the building has undergone many changes, most recently a $9.5 million renovation. But walking into the intricately painted auditorium with its towering proscenium arch, old-fashioned box seats on either side of the stage, and a majestic red curtain, The theater evokes the sense of a bygone era. Over the last decade, longtime freelance director Mark Robin has been at the helm of numerous shows at the Fulton Opera House. When the theater's previous artistic director, Michael Mitchell, died of cancer last September, Robin was tapped to step in as interim artistic director before accepting the position on a permanent basis this January. Robin believes his appointment comes at a pivotal time for the company.
Right now, we're sort of poised to go to whatever that next step is for this theater. For the last 9 years being a guest here, I've sort of watched it go from a largely almost community theater type operation to a quote unquote legitimate, you know, professional house. And now we have the opportunity to sort of become a major regional theater.
The theater is named for Robert Fulton, an American inventor who developed the first commercially successful steamboat. The Pennsylvania native is a continuing part of the theater's legacy, according to Barry Kornhauser, the Fulton Theater's playwright in residence.
We're coming to the statue of Robert Fulton, the namesake of the theater. It's carved out of one tree trunk, and for over 100 years, the statue stood outside the building. But after a long, long time of cruel winters and crueler pigeons, Robert wasn't doing so well, so they brought him in.
Kornhauser, who's worked at the Fulton for over 25 years and seems to know every chapter of the building's history, explains Fulton Hall, as it was originally known, was constructed on a plot of land where a colonial-era prison once stood, a site known for the 1763 massacre of Conestoga Indians at the hands of vigilantes. When Fulton Hall was designed in the mid-1800s by Philadelphia architect Samuel Sloan, a wall of the prison was left intact to form part of the building's foundation. Tobacco, raw wool, and even manure were stored in the basement of the structure, while the top floor was used as a shooting gallery. From the beginning, the main hall was used as a venue for plays, concerts, lectures, and other forms of entertainment. In the early 1870s, the owner of the hall decided to renovate the building into a more conventional theater space. The auditorium was lowered, balconies were added, and a proscenium arch was installed above the stage.
And this was called an opera house in those days because theater still had that kind of iffy reputation, but opera house sounded a little bit more impressive.
But it wasn't strictly opera.
It was never really opera at all. That was kind of the tradition at the time. People were railing against theater, so they thought, theater owners, that if they called the places opera houses, they could fool some of the people some of the time.
Kornhauser says many famous 19th and 20th century performers passed through the Fulton, including Mark Twain, Buffalo Bill Cody, and Wild Bill Hickok, Edwin Booth, Ethel Barrymore, and John Philip Sousa. The space went on to become a vaudeville venue, a movie house, and then a more traditional theater stage again, nearly closing its doors at different junctures, but always somehow surviving. While mindful of its history, managing director Aaron Young says today the company is committed to a contemporary mission.
We're not a museum. We honor what has been done in the past, but it's all about how do we move forward? How do we communicate with an audience now? How do we remain relevant in an era that, you know, has a lot of different options for people's leisure time? We no longer have a monopoly like, you know, we did back in the 1800s when the theater was built.
Remaining relevant to today's audiences, says Mark Robin, means paying close attention to the surrounding community.
You know, make sure that we're not moving so far towards, you know, the next rung of the ladder that we forget where we are to begin with. And that's going to be a really fun juggling act.
The Fulton Opera House is a larger-than-average theater. The horseshoe-shaped Italianate-style auditorium holds about 700 people. Aaron Young says keeping a facility of this size alive means being sensitive to popular demand.
We're more populist than a typical regional theater, because we are so large, we can't be a niche market. And so we tend to do things that will attract attention, but we'll do plays like Old Wicked Songs or Doubt or Pride's Crossing, things that are significant pieces of writing, particularly American drama, that need to be seen, even though we know that they're not going to attract the audiences that Fiddler on the Roof will attract.
The Fulton's new artistic director, Mark Robin, agrees that producing shows with a mass appeal is integral to the Fulton's success.
But I also don't want our entire goal to be about just putting on, you know, shows because they're going to sell. You know, I'd love to be developing new work here, as well as re-envisioning old work.
Though ambitious about the future, Robin says the state of today's economy forces the Fulton to be cautious.
So all the visions in the world mean nothing if we can't sort of turn this tide and turn this corner. So for the next year, possibly two, we're going to play it safer than we would like to eventually.
With Robin's long-term goal to build the Fulton's reputation as a leading regional theater in central Pennsylvania, the historic landmark will continue to be, as it has for more than 150 years, a place for people to gather, be entertained, and consider new ideas. An old architectural treasure and the new artistic director eager to take it into the 21st century, the Fulton story continues.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The home of the Fulton Theater in Lancaster continues its run as the nation's oldest continuously operating theater with the March 15th opening of the Spitfire Grill. There's a long tradition of great art being created by artists who either by choice or circumstance are far from home. With this in mind, the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, the organization founded in 1983 by the late Bibi Benaliel to help artists develop their careers, runs an alumni travel grant program. This program helps alumni take advantage of opportunities away from home that could expand their experience, broaden their horizons, and have a significant impact on their work. These include apprenticeships and residencies, the use of foreign facilities such as foundries and print shops, and international workshops. On Thursday, the work of the latest group of artists to have benefited from the Centre's travel grants will be the subject of a new exhibition. Earlier this week, we met with three of these artists and with the curator of the show and the director of the Career Development Program at the Centre for Emerging Visual Artists, Amy Potzik.
You know, artists today, your work is really influenced by where you travel, what you do in your life. And in order to move forward with your work, having the opportunity to get out of your context and then bring back to your community what you learn is so important. So it's really, we feel like it's a wonderful offering. And then in addition, not only having the travel, we give an exhibition to the artists where they also give a gallery talk. So very often you can get money to do a project, but not necessarily an exhibition with it or the opportunity to talk. So we try to give it as an all-encompassing opportunity.
With us are three of the artists who will be involved in the Alumni Travel Grant exhibition, among them James Mundy. James, where did you go? Who did you see? What did you learn?
I spent 2 weeks going to visit medical museums in London, Paris, Amsterdam, Utrecht, and Groningen. The main impetus for my travel was to go and visit some collections that aren't typically available to the public. So I was able to, with the permission of several curators, get behind-the-scenes tours and get some special access to things that you can't generally see unless you have a medical degree. And I don't, but it influences my work greatly. So it was a real pleasure to be able to have the time and the wherewithal to be able to go.
One wouldn't be surprised if you, as a sculptor, were going to these medical museums. As a printmaker, how did that translate into the work you produced?
Well, I was going and doing drawings on site as well as taking photographs. And since I've returned, I've translated many of those drawings into woodcuts, and I've started to turn some of them into etchings as well. So that's... And the prints of the photographs themselves are also sort of a new artistic output for me. I'd always taken photographs as study reference points, but never really thought to try and exhibit them. So now that I've realized, hey, these are kind of nifty in and of themselves, that's become a new expression mode for me.
And besides finding new source material, were you running into other artists? Were you having any other sort of artistic impetus on your travels?
Well, not so much in the medical museums, but the wonderful thing about being in places like London and Paris is that I had all of art history at my feet. I'd spent many hours when I wasn't poking through the Hunterian or the Musée du Poitrin. I was in the Louvre or in the British Museum and the National Gallery and soaking up all of that other wonderfulness that I, you know, you see it in books, but when you get to actually see it in person, that, you know, it's quite a different experience.
So, Anne Northrup, you went less far afield than James, spending a lot of your time in the United States on the trail of Lewis and Clark.
No, it wasn't that in the beginning at all. It turned into that. I had decided I wanted to go to places that were completely different. And I'm, you know, I've been a landscape painter for a number of years, and I use a lot of that imagery in my murals. So I just wanted to see places I had never seen except from the air. You know, so St. Louis, you can see from the air, there's something real special going on there, these enormous rivers. And in Wyoming, you have these roads that just go forever, and they end at one house, you know. So clearly there's really interesting stuff going on in these two places. So I thought, well, okay, one will be the water thing and the other will be the earth thing, and it'll be like elemental and it'll be really exciting and different from anything I've ever seen. But what happened is I got to St. Louis first and I started painting the giant rivers, and somebody slipped me a copy of Undaunted Courage, which is about Meriwether Lewis, which I didn't necessarily think had anything to do with me. But when I got out to Wyoming, I found myself painting the tributaries of the Missouri River. So I actually, it was really funny that, you know, here I had gone to find two very different places, and it was all about water. The whole thing was all about water and those rivers. So it was really kind of cool.
Michael Froyo is a photographer. Michael, where did you spend your travel grant, or how did you spend your travel grant?
Pennsylvania, actually. I didn't go very far. I did get as far as just west of Pittsburgh, but I spent about, I would say, 12 trips that averaged from 3 to 6 days documenting the former Pennsylvania Railroad from Harrisburg to Pittsburgh, which was sort of their trunk that funneled everything from the east and then to the Ohio River and split to the west. I've always been interested in trains, and I tried this project numerous times over the last 10 years and didn't really have the understanding of what I was looking at. And I think over, you know, projects that I've done in the last 5 years documenting historic buildings and spaces that are being torn down, I started to really get this fascination with things that were fading away. And while the railroad's still as busy as ever, the landscape around it is just fading away. The industries are going away. The people are changing. You know, there's a lot of people moving out.
How aware of this were you before you set out, and what surprises were there for you personally along the way?
There was a lot of surprises. There was a lot of places that I'd read about, I'd researched, but I'd never been. And Johnstown was a town that I ended up spending about, basing myself out of, I would say about 50% of the trips. And I could go back to Johnstown until I'm 60 years old to photograph. It's just an incredible place. The architecture, the history, the landscape is just unbelievable.
And how much is that about the destruction that took place there because of the flooding? That is the Johnstown.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few buildings that still stand. And, you know, Johnstown's gone through a pretty rough time between the mills closing. And it's a typical story of that area. But there's a lot of history. I mean, when you stand at the foot of where the dam actually broke in Sulksburg at the memorial, it's incredible. To think, you know, a wall of water that's way larger than you carrying Lord knows what. It was just incredible to stand there. And then to think about the history of you know, what people did to survive after that and sort of rebuild. And within, you know, a week, the railroad had trains running again. And, I mean, they aided a lot of people out there. So it was interesting to see, you know, from a contemporary viewpoint, how it's affected it and how the railroads rebuilt it and kept it alive.
Photographer Michael Froyo, printmaker James Mundy, and painter Ann Northrup, three of the artists whose work is featured in the Center for Emerging Visual Artists Alumni Travel Grant exhibition. We also heard from the show's curator, the director of the Career Development Program at the Center, Amy Potzik. The exhibition opens Thursday and runs through March 19th at the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, Suite 3A of the Barclay Building in Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. Gallery hours are Monday through Friday from 10 until 4, and on other days by appointment. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.